Readers are also reminded in the article that Procter & Gamble boasts that Vicks VapoRub is, quote, the only thing more powerful than a mother's touch, end quote. More powerful indeed.
Wow.
More powerful at inducing tracheal inflammation. So, if your grandma comes at you with Vicks VapoRub, run like the dickens and wave this article from chest in her face. Seriously, tell your families and your patients not to use it. Welcome to Keeping Up. Today, we're here again with Sheila McMorrow. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you, Clay. We're very excited to do our second installment.
Absolutely. And I just really appreciate you coming to do this. So this is Pediatrics Part 2. There were so many articles that we couldn't cover it in one sitting. So get ready. These are from the past 6 months, or roughly thereabouts, except for one, which I accidentally put in the wrong pile, but it's from like 2007. But alas,
still relevant.
It's a very good article and it needs to be in there. So without further ado, we'll get started.
Our first article is by Atkins. It's called Epidemiology and Outcomes from Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest in Children, and it's from Circulation from last month, March of 2009. So the historical backdrop, luckily, most of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is fortunately an uncommon pediatric disease. Therefore, studies on out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in pediatrics is very limiting because it's very difficult to obtain an adequate sample size. But this study from Circulation sought to utilize the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium, which have sites around the United States and Canada. There's a variety of settings that the consortium is involved with. They're both private hospitals, public hospitals, urban hospitals, rural hospitals. They have centralized and decentralized EMS units, and they use all of these settings to evaluate out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the pediatric population. So with the study, they hypothesized that mortality would likely be higher than adult out-of-hospital cardiac arrest due to the fact that in most adults there's a rhythm disturbance that if you can quickly correct it, it can result in lower mortality. So their hypothesis was that mortality would be higher than adults. So in terms of board relevance, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in pediatrics still has a very high morbidity and mortality. And most of these kids, when they're less than 12 months, there's no identifiable cause. And these are your classic SIDS deaths when there is no identifiable cause found. So the results of the study, they included patients that were less than 20 years old, between birth and 20, and they excluded patients that they knew were either traumas, burns, or drownings. And there were 625 patients less than 20 years in the study period, and there were 25,000 patients over the age of 20 during the study period. So 44% of the pediatric patients were infants, so they were less than 12 months, and two-thirds of them were male. This incidence in terms of 100,000 patients, there are 8 pediatric patients per 100,000 versus 127 adult patients per 100,000. In the pediatric out-of-hospital arrest, bystander CPR was administered in about a third of the time, and VTAC and VFib was the initial rhythm in only about 5% of infants and 15% of adolescents. So survival to hospital discharge was 6% for all pediatric patients. It was 3% for infants, 9% for children, and 9% for adolescents, versus 4% for adults that had out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. In terms of odds ratios compared to the adult population, the infants had a lower odds ratio, which was 0.7. Age 12 months to 12 years old had a 2.1 odds ratio, which their survival was twice as likely as adults. And adolescents had a 2.0 odds ratio, which was twice as likely as adults to survive out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So also further breakdown was that 19% of pediatric patients received no EMS intervention, meaning that they were actually already either had signs of lividity or were cold and stiff when EMS arrived, and 40% of adults that received no intervention. So basically, from this study, from their 625 patients of kids that had out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, children over 12 months are more likely to survive to discharge than adults are. In adolescents, it's similar. But children under 12 months have a less likely chance to survive as compared to adults.
Yeah, we usually think of PEDS, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, as the caboose of a very long train. I mean, it's usually that physiologically their reserves are just completely exhausted, and arrest is at the very, very end. And so the thinking is you're not going to get them back. But what they, I mean, what they actually found, bottom line, was more children do survive out of hospital cardiac arrest. But still, we're talking about only 6%. Mm-hmm. That's really abysmal survival rate. So mm-hmm. once again, the only treatment really for arrest is prevention. All right. That was a morbid article.
Not your, not very uplifting.
Have a nice day.
Yeah. On to the next one.
Yes. This is by Awasthi et al. Is hospital admission and observation required after a normal abdominal computed tomography scan in children with blunt abdominal trauma? It was written in Academic Emergency Medicine, October 2008. Now here's the historical backdrop. Older generation CT scanners had lower sensitivity for detecting subtle intra-abdominal injury in children. And pancreatic and hollow viscous injuries could often go undetected. The resolution just wasn't that good in these older scanners. Therefore, a lot of children with blunt abdominal trauma were admitted to the hospital for serial abdominal exams despite having a normal CT scan. Well, this study sought to determine the outcome of children with a normal CT scan of the abdomen in the setting of blunt trauma. Now, board relevance. Beware the CT with intra-abdominal free fluid and no solid organ injury. This may represent hollow viscous injury, bowel injury. Also, beware the seatbelt sign or seatbelt mark across the abdomen. This is associated with a high risk of hollow viscous injury. Now, some previous work by some of the same authors showed that 30% of children with a seatbelt sign, that is a big bruise where the seatbelt hit across their abdomen, were subsequently diagnosed with intra-abdominal injury. So consider admission of such children, especially if they have abdominal tenderness. Now, this is in spite of this article, because the same authors wrote that. If you want that reference, go to the website, and you can get that link on the written summaries part of the website. It's keepingupinem.com. Just register, go to written summaries, and you can get that. Now, the results of the article. This study was done with 16-slice CT using IV contrast only in children less than 18 years of age. The primary outcome was intra-abdominal injury or intra-abdominal injury requiring intervention. 1,295 patients underwent CT, and 1,085 had normal scans. Of these, 737 were admitted, and 348 were discharged. None of the patients discharged had intra-abdominal injury subsequently diagnosed. Now, two of the admitted patients with negative CT had subsequent intra-abdominal injury diagnosed. One had multiple areas of mesenteric hematoma and a 75% serosal tear at laparotomy. However, there was no repair required. The other patient had a significant drop in hematocrit, and repeat CT scanning showed a perinephric hematoma that, again, it didn't require intervention. The negative predictive value for developing intra-abdominal injury was 99.8% for just having an injury subsequently diagnosed, and for intra-abdominal injury requiring intervention was 100% negative predictive value. So how does this apply to your practice on your next shift? In general, admission of children with a negative abdominal CT for serial abdominal examination is unnecessary in today's multi-slice scanners. Now, we're way beyond even 16-slice. The only caveat is to watch out for children with a seatbelt mark on the abdomen if they have abdominal abrasions or if they have persistent abdominal tenderness. I think you should still consider admitting those kids. The others are safe to go if no other findings warrant admission after their blunt trauma to their abdomen. What's your practice with that, Sheila?
Well, I think that in our pediatric trauma service here, kids that do have seatbelt signs, they are observed for or they're admitted for observation. Yep. However, I think they let those kids start with clear fluids pretty quickly, even after admission. So I think the large majority, like you say, from the study too, do not ever need operative intervention. But there are the kids that you do worry about microperfs that present later. But those are the kids that I think would present themselves with increasing abdominal pain or other peritoneal signs.
I think that's right. If they have a seatbelt mark, you just need to have a higher level of concern, higher level of suspicion, lower threshold for admission. Mm-hmm. Certainly if they have persistent abdominal tenderness, I watch those kids. And if you do decide to send them home if they have a negative CT, definitely give the family good discharge instructions and return instructions, so that if they develop significant tenderness, you know, small bowel injury, they immediately come back.
Our next article is a good kind of follow-up to that in reference to abdominal pain and something we all love, appendicitis, something we kind of all worry about missing as well. But this is by Bailey et al. It's the efficacy and impact of IV morphine before surgical consultation in children with right lower quadrant pain suggestive of appendicitis. And it's a randomized controlled trial. So this was published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2007. But I think definitely has very good practical guidelines for us today.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I thought it was 2008.
No.
You know, I saved it as in the 2008 file, but it's actually a little bit older, so...
That's right.
But we still need to know about it.
Exactly. So, the historical backdrop, there's still tons of kids that come to the ER with abdominal pain. Some of it, right lower quadrant. So the biggest decision is this appendicitis or is it not appendicitis? And do we give pain meds before a surgeon sees them or not? Because I think there's always an underlying feeling, am I going to mask the surgical condition if we do give morphine? But you really don't want a kid to sit there in pain while they're waiting for the surgeon. So resistance to giving analgesia to kids is still present, but there's more and more data in the adult population that's emerged that has gone against and has been in favor of treating patients with morphine or with IV analgesia before surgical evaluation. So this study sought to determine the efficacy of morphine before consultation and whether it has any impact on the time between the emergency department arrival and the surgical decision. So, board relevance, if there's anyone, any age, but particularly children with signs and symptoms of appendicitis, they need immediate surgical consultation, even if you do or don't give IV analgesia. So this study, it was any child between 8 and 18 years of age with a presumptive diagnosis of appendicitis. And that presumptive diagnosis was made after the clinical exam and history by the emergency department physician. So they were enrolled if they had if they complained of pain, if they ranked their pain at least 5 out of 10 on a scale, on a FACES scale. And they received either morphine at 0.1 milligrams per kilo at a max of 5 milligrams, or they received placebo. The patients were included if the pain was present for 3 days or less and had 2 of the following signs or symptoms. If they had vomiting, if they had temp over 100.4, which is 38 degrees Celsius, if they had right lower quadrant tenderness, if they had migration of pain to the right lower quadrant, if they had right lower quadrant guarding, if they had the Rob-Singh sign, or if they had a SOAS sign. Those kids were the ones that were included. Excluded were kids that if they already had 3 days or 3 or more days of abdominal pain, if they already knew that they had appendicitis either by a CT or an ultrasound, if they had received narcotics already, if they had sickle cell disease, if they had any kind of prior abdominal surgery, if they were allergic to morphine, they were excluded, or if they were pregnant. So in this study period, 90 patients between 8 and 18 were enrolled, and surgical assessment was performed within 2 hours of receiving either morphine or placebo, and then there was a 30-minute ED assessment after they received morphine or placebo. And what they found in this study was that there was no difference in the decrease in pain after 30 minutes between the two groups, which was very interesting. Even kids that received morphine, they had the same pain scale after 30 minutes that the children that received placebo had. And more importantly, too, there was no difference in the mean time to surgical decision between the two groups. It was 156 minutes for the placebo group and 165 minutes for the morphine group. Also interesting was that after 30 minutes, they lost their involuntary guarding. 23% of the morphine group lost their involuntary guarding, and 33% of placebo did. And a fairly significant amount of kids lost their rebound tenderness as well. Morphine, the group of morphine, about a third of those lost rebound tenderness, and 13% in placebo. So they might have lost some of their signs that they initially had when before the surgeon evaluated them, but in the end, it did not affect the surgical decision time. So in both groups, there were 2 to 3 patients that had a normal appendix in the operating room, and one patient who received placebo was a missed appendicitis and had been admitted for observation, went home, was pain-free for 7 days, and then came back with an abscess. The limitations in this group is that the hospital that this was performed in, it was in Canada, none of the children had CT scans that were done. And ultrasounds were performed in about a third of patients. So this was purely on clinical exam by the emergency department physician and the surgeon. And in the United States, at least in most of the practices that we're at, we do some kind of imaging modality at the time in conjunction with the surgeon's evaluation. So application to practice, kids that you think have appendicitis, if they get IV morphine, it shouldn't impair the ability of the surgeon to make a decision. So if a kid's in pain, you should treat it.
Do you use any decision rules when you're thinking about appendicitis? Like there was a study that came out in pediatrics a few years ago that said they derived it and then validated it. That's and they found that if there's absence of tenor to palpation, an absolute neutrophil count less than 6,750, and if they had absence of nausea, meaning they felt like they could eat, it was a negative predictive value near 100% in that population. Do you kind of have a grid that you filter kids with appendicitis or suspected appendicitis?
I feel like I've had so many surprises, too. Yeah. I mean, I've had kids that have starving and have just eaten a hamburger and they have an appy on CT.
Yeah.
And so it's, I feel like, and that's probably why there's so much controversy, and there's so many studies and so many trying to come up with some kind of consistent decision rules, because there's just not consistent ones.
Appendicitis doesn't play fair.
Yeah.
It'll not be on the right. It'll be in the midline, or it'll be too high, or, you know, there.
Yeah, or back pain, or, Well, I think there's going to be missed ones if you stick to a certain criteria. I think you'll have missed.
I really wish that our center would move more toward an exam-based, an exam-driven workup, though, because if we're highly suspicious, then we get the surgeons involved. If they're highly suspicious, just go to the OR, or at least go from exam to ultrasound. If it's non-diagnostic, then to CT.
Yeah.
We still would be scanning fewer children.
Yeah.
I'd like to see it move in that direction.
I think that in talking to some of our surgical colleagues here, I think that 20 years ago when our imaging was not as good, that was definitely the exam was probably the key point. And I think, but now that imaging has become so good in terms of detail, you know, the prior negative appy rate was between 5 and 10%, and they now view that as too high, that they don't want to have even a 5 to 10% normal appendix rate in taking a kid to the OR. So they would actually rather scan the kids, which you can still argue.
Yeah.
And that's why we see the increase in radiation exposure and other problems with that. But
I don't think we're going to solve this today.
No, but it's interesting. It's going to continue.
Yeah, I think so too. Maybe we'll get quicker MRIs. I mean,
maybe.
Yeah. Oh, well, again, not today. Well, our next article is by Damore et al. Prospective multicenter bronchiolitis study. Predicting ICU admissions. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine, October of 2008. The historical backdrop. One of our chief roles as PEDSM physicians is to determine which child with bronchiolitis needs admission. And then after that, we need to know which kids are sick enough to warrant ICU admission. So wouldn't it be nice if we had some clinical predictors to aid our decision making here? Well, this study aims to help us figure out which kids are going to need the ICU versus general ward care. As far as board relevance, in general, children with low pulse oximetry, poor PO intake, significant increased worker breathing, and younger age are going to more likely be the ones that need admission. But getting into this study, the results of this study to find out who needs the ICU. This was a prospective observational cohort study involving 30 emergency departments. 1,456 patients were enrolled, of which 533, that's 37%, were admitted to the floor, and 50, that's 3%, were admitted to the ICU. The advantage of this study was its large size and use of multivariate logistic regression to control for confounders. So, what they found, to cut to the chase, predictors of ICU admission after multivariate analysis were, number one, age less than 2 months. Number two, an ED visit in the past week. Number three, moderate to severe retractions. And number four, inadequate oral intake. Now, as you can tell, those last two are subjective, but that's the way it shaked out as far as what was significant statistically. Now, interestingly, not associated with ICU admission were male gender. We all know that males are weaker.
For the time being.
Right? Socioeconomic factors, insurance status, breastfeeding, family history of asthma, chest x-ray result, low birth weight, prematurity, chronic medical illness, or, surprisingly, hypoxia.
Yeah.
None of those ended up panning out as independent predictors on multivariate analysis, which is contrary to some prior studies. But this is one of the biggest studies that's been done. Now, how does this apply to your practice? Well, I think these four criteria, age less than 2 months, ED visit in the past week, moderate to severe retractions, and inadequate oral intake, can help us at the bedside when we're trying to make disposition decisions. Now, sometimes it's clear the moment you walk into the room that this patient needs intubation, they need to go on the vent, or they are going to the ICU, no way I'm sending this kid to the floor. This study really helps us with those tweeners, you know, the kids that are kind of sicker, but they're not obvious ICU players. Mm-hmm. So if they have any of these four, lower your threshold for ICU dispo. Is that kind of the way you think about that?
Yeah,
it's kind of intuitive.
But you're right. There are some kids that from the get-go, you know, they're either going to need CPAP or Vapotherm or some other adjunct that is not going to fly on a regular ward. It's not your, you know, kid that's bronchiolitis that's going to just need frequent suctioning. It's somebody who's going to need a little bit more airway support. But it was surprising that prematurity and low birth weight and things like
and chronic medical problems.
And chronic medical problems.
And hypoxia.
Yeah.
I thought that was odd.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to go with what you have.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say, obviously, even though this is the largest study, it's multi-centered, there still were only 50 kids in the ICU group. So, I mean, we're still not dealing with huge numbers.
Yeah.
So it's possible with a larger study group, if that, you know,
they
were conceivable.
Yeah.
And, you know, hypoxia would probably shake out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Certainly it factors into our decision-making intuitively.
Yeah.
Kids that DSAT, as soon as you take them off, I mean.
And there was another article in the New England Journal of Medicine 2 months ago in February of 2009 by Hall, just talking about the burden of RSV, too. And we know that RSV is a big factor in the bronchiolitics in this younger age group, particularly in kids less than 2 months, but also in the kids less than 12 to 18 months that have to be hospitalized. But this kind of study went to just specify where RSV is, and it's definitely still present in kids up to 4 and 5 years old. But in those kids, by and large, they are not affected in the way that the younger kids are affected. And even though they have RSV and can have audible wheezing, they very rarely need admission with those infections.
You know, in that New England Journal article, I was shocked at the percentage of overall hospital admissions. It's like 18%. It was just this extraordinarily high number.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we definitely feel the burden.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's an aptly named article.
That's right. Burden indeed. Next article is by Panikkar et al. And this was an article that was done and published in England or from England. It's called, oral prednisolone for preschool children with acute virus-induced wheezing. And that was in the New England Journal of Medicine in January 2009. So historical backdrop, there are a significant number of patients who present in this preschool age children, less than five, with wheezing and neurisms. And a lot of these kids we know have wheezing induced because of colds. School age children and adults and adolescents who classically present with repetitive wheezing episodes usually have chronic symptoms in between viral infections. And once they reach school age, the kids that have persistence in wheezing, we usually label as being asthmatics. So this study sought to determine the efficacy of oral steroids in preschool age children who present with bronchospasm. So the board relevance is, do you treat these preschool age kids with steroids when they wheeze, when they come to the ED? So they took kids between 10 months and 5 years. They were trying to weed out the younger kids that had bronchiolitis. So they included 10 months to 5 years old who were found to be wheezing upon presentation to 3 different hospitals in London. They were given 1 neb or 10 puffs of albuterol at the time. If the wheezing persisted, then they were randomized to receive either placebo or steroids. And if they were under 2 years of age, they received 10 milligrams of prednisolone a day, each day for 5 days. And if they were over 2 years, they received 20 milligrams of prednisolone. And then they were admitted to the hospital or to an observation unit. So the average discharge time for people, for children that received placebo was 12 hours, and the average discharge time for children that received steroids was 10 hours. So there was actually with no significant difference in between the two groups. There were a total of 700 patients that were enrolled. The mean age was 15 and 16 months, respectively, between each group. And they used a PRAM score, which was the preschool respiratory assessment measurement, at the onset, at 4 hours, at 12 hours, and if they were still there, at 24 hours after admission. Interestingly, 40% of the kids had eczema in each arm. 25% of each arm had one parent, at least, that had a history of asthma. 30% had no prior episodes of wheezing, and 30% had 1 to 3 prior episodes of wheezing. So I thought this was very interesting because we see these kids that come in with prior wheezing episodes, the parents have asthma, the kid has eczema, you just know the kid's going to be atopic. But there was no difference in this study between kids that got steroids and kids that got placebo. And so they just were admitted for scheduled albuterol bronchodilators, but didn't really have any change in terms of how quickly they got better if they received steroids or not. And there was no difference between the two groups between when they returned to their baseline activities or for rehospitalization. So in application to practice, in kids that are these preschool age children, less than 5, even with a history of eczema or parental history of asthma, steroids may not be helpful, according to the study. There were definitely limitations to the study, and I think they do need larger numbers of patients, and they commented even that they needed larger numbers to actually obtain an adequate power. And I tend to, if kids have eczema and parents have asthma and they respond to albuterol, I tend to treat them as responders and treat them as there must be some kind of inflammatory response that we can actually affect with steroids. So I still treat these kids.
I know. I think I'll have a hard time. The study's compelling. It's just I think it probably won't change my practice. If they're atopic and there's a strong family history of asthma, I'm probably going to err on the side of treating them. And I think the point is, the more frequently children are exposed to systemic steroids, mm-hmm. the more complications you're going to have. In that same episode of New England Journal, Ducharme et al. Wrote an article, Preemptive Use of High-Dose Fluticasone for Virus-Induced Wheezing in Young Children. So it's kind of the idea of, at the first sign of a cold, we're going to give them very high dose fluticasone, and it was 1,500 micrograms. So this is mega high dose.
Yeah.
And it was sort of subjective. The parents said, we think they have a cold. We're going to give this treatment. And what they found was it actually did decrease the amount of wheezing that the kids had and beta agonist use. However, the problem was in the group treated with the active drug, fluticasone, they had decreased growth as far as both height and weight, which is the weight was an interesting thing. So the conclusion is we probably better hold off on selective, preemptive, high-dose inhaled steroid use at this point to be sort of take a preemptive strike and prevent hospitalization or wheezing, and just do PRN beta-2 agonists. So I think these studies are, I mean, they're well done. Randomized controlled trials. This is good science. It's just I think I'm probably still going to be giving some atopic kids steroids.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to not think that they're going to benefit. And it's interesting, too. I mean, most of these kids went home within 12 hours of coming to the ER. So they still did not have long protracted hospital stays or anything. And so it seems like even the kids who got placebo just might have needed more aggressive and more frequent beta agonists. Something to think of.
Definitely in your sicker kids, though. And the authors of both studies said, certainly in the kids that are more ill or you think are going to be needing escalated care, potential ICU care, definitely give steroids. And I think as far as for your boards, obviously kids with prior history of known asthma, repetitive wheezing, definitely give steroids in those, because it is important at decreasing the inflammation. We usually start with 2 milligrams per kilogram. And I think oral is just as good as IV, unless they can't take PO. Okay, next up, Hsu et al. Effective pneumococcal conjugate vaccine on pneumococcal meningitis. This was in New England Journal, January 2009. Historical backdrop. In the year 2000, a heptavalent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, we're going to call that, and I'm sorry, we're going to call it Prevnar because it's just easier to say.
Yeah.
PCV7, I'm not going to say heptavalent pneumococcal conjugate vaccine this many times. Prevnar was introduced to prevent invasive Streptococcus pneumoniae disease. Its effect on meningitis was not known. So this study sought to determine the change in meningitis from 1998-99, before the vaccine, compared with 2000 and beyond after the Prevnar vaccine. Now the CDC performs active bacterial core surveillance for invasive pneumococcal disease. There were 8 sites that made up this study. Serotypes were obtained and antibiotic sensitivities were obtained as well. So for your boards, in the Haemophilus influenza type B or HIB and Prevnar vaccine era, the face of meningitis has dramatically changed. HIB meningitis is virtually never seen, and despite Prevnar, the predominant form of meningitis is still pneumococcal. That's important. Bear in mind that if you have a high suspicion for bacterial meningitis, it's one of those things where you shoot first and ask questions later. That is, give antibiotics as soon as possible. If you have a kid and you're worried, you say this kid's got meningitis, give ceftriaxone first because it can be given very quickly. And then add the vancomycin next, as many pneumococcal strains are highly resistant to beta-lactam antibiotics. Even though you give antibiotics, the Gram stain will often still be positive, and your CSF white counts are still going to be very reliable. If it's with, you know, the Gram stain will often be positive, even if you get the tap a few hours later. Mm-hmm. So that's important for your boards. Shoot first, ask questions later, and give vanc.
Early.
Because, yeah. Go ahead and get it on board because there's so much pneumococcal resistance out there. The results. 1,379 cases of pneumococcal meningitis were identified. The median age in children was 15 months and in adults was 53 years. The case fatality was 8.4% in children and 22.3% in adults. Overall, the rate of meningitis decreased about 30% from 1.1 to 0.79 cases per 100,000 persons before and after the Prevnar vaccine. Now, the heptavalent vaccine and the related serotypes had a decline in incidence. As you would suspect, if the vaccine covers that strain, you're going to see less of that strain, and that's indeed what was seen. However, the incidence of non-Prevnar serotypes, the ones not in the vaccine, actually increased once the vaccine was introduced. You might kind of think that intuitively too, and that's indeed what happened. Penicillin resistance decreased initially from 98 to 03, but it increased again between 03 and 05. Overall penicillin resistance was 27.8%, almost 30%. So that's why in the board relevance you need to add vancomycin. So how does this apply to your practice? Well, pneumococcal meningitis is still around, despite Prevnar, and non-PCV7 or non-Prevnar strains are increasing in incidence. Penicillin resistance is also still very high, so if you suspect bacterial meningitis, get the vanc on board. Yeah. That's my take on this study.
Yeah. No, and there was a similar study looking at pneumonia pre and post Prevnar vaccine that was in PEDS emergency care in January of 2009. And they looked at young kids who, before the Prevnar vaccine was universally distributed, and some of those kids were diagnosed with lobar pneumonia, and this was in kids with fever and a white count of over 20,000, and so before vaccination with Prevnar, it was found in 21% of kids with fever that they had pneumonia, without really any other symptoms, and then after vaccination, it was still present in 18%. So I guess pre and post Prevnar in terms of pneumonias and lobar pneumonias, I think if the kid looks sick and there's no other source, then an x-ray is a reasonable thing to get, particularly if they do have a high white count. But so in terms of pneumonia statistics, that hasn't markedly changed.
So pneumococcus is still out there. It's still the most common cause for bacterial meningitis. far more than meningococcal meningitis. So you've still got to think about it, and you have to be aggressive and just assume that it's got beta-lactam resistance.
So this is a great follow-up discussion to our next article, which is by Wilkinson et al. It's from Academic Emergency Medicine in March of 2009. Prevalence of occult bacteremia in children aged 3 to 36 months presenting to the emergency department with fever in the post-pneumococcal conjugate vaccine era.
Bada-bing.
A.K.A. Prevnar. I love this article because it is so relevant to practice.
Yeah.
So the historical backdrop, the evaluation of a well-appearing febrile child between 3 months and 3 years has always been an area of debate and research, particularly now with the drop in occult pneumococcal bacteremia since the advent of Prevnar. This is even more of a topic for children without a fever source. So in 2000, when Prevnar came out, there were guidelines by the AAP recommending eliminating the workup for occult bacteremia once the vaccination had been widely used. And the incidence of pneumococcal occult bacteremia in 2001 was 0.24 to 0.91%, with the overall occult bacteremia percentage as 0.65 to 0.9%. So this study sought to determine the prevalence of occult bacteremia in healthy appearing children 3 to 36 months in the post-Prevnar area, as well as the incidence broken down by age group and which kids had received which how much of their vaccine sequence. So in terms of board relevance, does a white count in this age group mean anything, particularly as it in relation to what it meant before Prevnar? And is a blood culture necessary?
No. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
So in terms of this, this was a very well-done article. It's a in light of the fact that it was a retrospective cohort study. But it was done in an urban emergency department that the volume, which sees 55,000 kids a year, and any child that appeared well between the ages of 3 and 36 months that presented to the emergency department over a three-year period with a temp of over 39 degrees and no identifiable source had a blood culture. So kids that were excluded were those that looked sick, those that were admitted to the hospital, those that had central lines, those that were immunodeficient, your oncology patients, or if there was an identifiable source of infection besides ear infection. So if you knew that they had herpes angina or you know they had pneumonia, those kids were not included. But if they had ear infections, those kids were included and got blood cultures just to see the incidence of bacteremia from ear infections. So 8,413 kids had blood cultures. 185 of those cultures grew, which is only 2% of the blood cultures that were grown, and 86% of the cultures were contaminants. So that leaves very little, at least 14% of the cultures that were true pathogens, and 0.3% of all the blood cultures that were drawn positive, true positive. So the total occult bacteremia percentage is 0.3%, and strep pneumo is 0.17% of the total. So when they broke it down by age, the kids between 3 and 12 months had a total occult bacteremia rate of 0.26. So the kids that had received maybe only one, maybe two, or maybe three of their Prevnar doses. The kids between 12 and 24 months, which should have received the initial three doses, the occult bacteremia rate was 0.17%. And the kids over 2 years, between 2 and 3 years, the occult bacteremia rate was 0.5%. And there was no clinical significance between the two age groups. So despite all this published literature since 2000, since the advent of Prevnar, pediatric providers and emergency department providers continue to obtain CBCs and blood cultures in this age group. And there is still the possibility that serotypes not covered by the vaccine can account for some of the cases of occult bacteremia in the pneumococcal breakdown. But in terms of applying this to practice, a white count is not useful in guiding empiric antibiotic therapy in kids between 3 and 36 months. We no longer live in the age of occult bacteremia since the advent of Prevnar. So in the post-Prevnar era, occult bacteremia is very uncommon. And when it is present, it's other organisms, the organisms that were after pneumococcus that were found in this study were E. coli and Salmonella. But due to this, because of the low incidence of this, that there's no indication to empirically treat these children with fever with a dose of IM antibiotics if they are well appearing. Now, this excludes kids that do not look well. If they don't look well, then by all means, I would get a blood culture. But in kids that look great, that don't have a source, There's no need even to get a blood culture, much less a CBC.
So I totally agree with this. What we find is that we're having so many contaminants that we're chasing down contaminants. And so the morbidity associated with that and the expense and the administrative cost for tracking down these people that, well, their blood culture grew, is it contaminant, is it not? And you have to factor in the amount of patients just in the baseline population that are going to have allergic reactions to an empiric dose of an antibiotic, ceftriaxone or whatever, or other associated complications, C. difficile, colitis, things along that that line. So what it seems like we're finding is that the incidence of pneumococcal bacteremia is so low in this time period that the complications really outweigh the benefits of getting the test. Even in this article in Academic Emergency Medicine, it was something like, in order to save one life, you would have to treat 184,000 people and get that many cultures.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's another article that came out also in June of 08 in Archives of Disease and Childhood that was from Duke, and it showed very similar findings. What they found was that in the Prevnar age, the incidence of occult bacteremia due to pneumococcus is very, very low, and they still recommend not getting a blood culture and CBC and not giving empiric antibiotic therapy, so that there's a unified voice between these journals.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the British have gone to the NICE guidelines, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, and I think that would be wise for us to adopt here in the U.S. as well and start doing some fewer tests on these kids. Now, I think one caveat is urine.
Correct, yeah.
The rate of UTIs has not changed in the Hib and Prevnar area.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that I'm still doing. If I have a kid, fever without localizing signs, in that 3 to 36-month age range,
mm-hmm.
really strongly consider getting urine.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and in the kids that have gotten none of their Prevnar shots.
Definitely.
Which is another subset of patients that even with herd immunity, they might not. They are probably still susceptible to invasive pneumococcal disease. But hopefully most children are being vaccinated with the Prevnar series, and most healthy children who have received even one dose of their Prevnar, there was not any significant difference between if they received one or if they received all completed their series. Yeah.
All right. Next up, Kimia et al. Utility of lumbar puncture for first simple febrile seizure among children 6 to 18 months of age. This is in Pediatrics, January 2008. Historical backdrop. The AAP practice parameter from May 1996 says that lumbar puncture should be, quote, strongly considered in all children with first simple febrile seizure younger than 12 months. Now, the words of noted pediatric neurologist Dr. Gerald Finichel at our institution with his inimitable Bostonian accent still ring in my ears. If the child is acting normally before the febrile seizure and they act normally after the febrile seizure, it's not meningitis. Kids with meningitis who seize don't act normal.
That's what he says. That's so true.
But he says it kind of better than that.
They don't like that.
I mean, I'm from Illinois. I can't do a Boston accent. It's okay. So anyway, it's been common practice at our institution for at least the past 10 years to never do a lumbar puncture in a child with febrile seizure, assuming the, we'll call it, Finichel's criterion was met. They look normal before. They're acting normal now. You literally have to tie them down. You don't need to do an LP on that kid. Now, board relevance. Simple febrile seizures generally occur in children 6 months to 5 years. They last, by definition, less than 15 minutes. They're generalized, that is, non-focal. They're associated with fever, obviously, as the name would suggest, and they occur only once in 24 hours. That's the definition of a simple febrile seizure. If these criteria are not present and the seizure is greater than 15 minutes, it's focal, greater than 1 in 24 hours, then by definition, it's a complex febrile seizure. And that being said, a lot of kids have multiple simple febrile seizures within 24 hours, and the neurologists don't get too excited about that, but it's, you know, it's the textbook definition.
Mm-hmm.
Also, simple febrile seizures occur in about 2-5% of all children, very common, and they have about a 33% recurrence rate. So you need to counsel families the next time your child has a febrile illness, maybe this febrile illness, it could happen again. The prognosis is excellent. The risk of developing epilepsy is just slightly above baseline risk, which is already very low for the entire population. So that's what you need to know about febrile seizures for your boards. Now, the results of this article, it turns out we're not the only people here at Vanderbilt not doing lumbar punctures on kids with first simple febrile seizure. This was a retrospective cohort study to determine compliance with the AAP practice parameter and the number of cases of bacterial meningitis in this population from 1995 to 2006. 704 cases of first simple febrile seizure were identified, and of these, 271 had lumbar puncture attempted. That's 38%. 260 actually had successful lumbar puncture. CSF pleocytosis occurred in 10 out of the 260, but none of these children grew a pathogen. 10 of them, that's 3.8%, grew confirmed contaminants. And no children returned to that facility with a subsequent diagnosis of meningitis. So how does this apply to your practice? Well, this study, I think, provides the impetus needed to revise the existing AAP practice parameter. Our rate of lumbar puncture and febrile seizure has got to be much lower than 38%. I mean, we're just not doing that. I mean, we'll look for a source of fever if there's no other localizing symptoms, as in checking a urine often, but with such a low incidence of bacterial meningitis in this population and the known complications of LP and a 3.8% contaminated sample rate, it seems wise to refrain from LP in most of these cases of first simple febrile seizure. Now, beware of the following caveats. This does not deal with complex febrile seizures. It's not talking about an ill-appearing child. And it's not talking about a child who has abnormal mental status before or after the seizure, you know, accounting for the usual postictal phase. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you find yourself doing down in the PTD?
Yeah, you know, I think by the time we see, we're kind of lucky because by the time the seizure happens and then EMS arrives and en route they might be postictal or starting to wake up. When they come see us, a lot of them have kind of started to return to baseline. I've had two kids that I tapped because they slept for like 3 hours after.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't comfortable with. And then I don't know if the seizure hit them right when they were ready to take a nap, and that's what it coincided with.
The taps were negative.
But the taps were both negative. Yeah. So, and they did another study. They looked at down in Miami at Miami Children's too. They looked at how closely the guidelines were being followed. And this was from Peace Emergency Care in January of 2009, that they looked at 242 kids that had come in with a febrile seizure. And 56 of these kids were in the 6 to 12 months. And half of them underwent LPs, all of which were sterile. And so this just kind of showed that they weren't also following the AAP guidelines, and that in this, as different epidemiologic disease pathogens arise, that maybe the guidelines need to be revised. And
certainly in 96, I mean, we're talking about pre-Prevnar age. Yeah. And so, the face of meningitis has changed. And one of our faculty who's been here longer than us, who actually helped train me, said, man, we used to just pray that the kids would still come in and be postictal. And we'd literally run in the room, consent the parents as fast as we could, and try to tap them while they were postictal. And he said, all the taps are negative.
Yeah.
So I think Dr. Finishel's rule works. I mean, if they're acting fine, and then they seize, and then they are postictal, and then they're waking up and acting fine and running around eating Teddy Grahams.
Yeah.
I pray.
It's hard to tap a kid like that.
You don't need to tap that kid.
Yeah. If they're seizing because of meningitis, they're not going to wake up.
Yeah, and they're not going to ever get back to normal. And
or
if it's complex focal, you know, or they look bad.
Funny, yeah.
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 Or you look funny.
Or your mom looks funnier.
Just tap them.
Our next articles are just two little blurbs from the MMWR. The first one is from January 2009, and it reports invasive H flu type B disease in 5 kids in Minnesota. So certainly in the last 10 to 20 years since the HIV vaccine has come out and been widely administered, the disease has largely gone away. But now as vaccination has somewhat fallen mainly due to parental choice, they actually have seen a resurgence in the disease. And there were 5 kids in Minnesota that were that had invasive HIV disease, type B, last year, which was the largest number that they had had since like 1992 when the HIV vaccine first came out. So keep, for board relevance, keep H-flu in your differential in these unimmunized kids that come in that might be sick. So there were 5 kids. They were 5 months old to 3 years who had invasive H-flu disease, and one died. One of the children had completed the primary HIB series but actually had an immunodeficiency, which was hypogammaglobulinemia, later. But they had actually received their series. 3 of them had received no doses of HIB because of parental refusal for vaccines. And then the 5-month-old had actually received the 2 and 4-month doses. So there was a shortage of HIV vaccine actually in 2007 and 2008. And so the CDC, because of this, recommended that the primary vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months be completed, and that the 12 to 15-month administration be tailored for kids that were at higher risk. 3 of the 5 kids had meningitis, which the one was at 17 months or 7 months that hadn't received any vaccines. There was the 15-month-old had received two doses and then had not received the third because of the shortage. And then the 5-month-old had received 2 and 4 month doses. One had pneumonia at 3 years of age and had not been immunized. And one had epiglottitis at 20 months, which is what we always used to see, HIB. And this child was 20 months old and had no vaccines. So before HIB, before the vaccine, Haemophilus influenza type B was the most common cause of bacterial meningitis in kids less than 5. And since the HIV vaccine, the incidence has decreased more than 1,000-fold. And so, but in kids that haven't been immunized, even herd immunity now is sometimes not enough. And so asking vaccination status is really important. The other MMWR report, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report from February of 2009, was talking about the Salmonella outbreak in multiple states. And this reported 529 patients from September of 2008 to mid-January of 2009. The median age was 16 years. About 20% were less than 5 years old, and 15% were older than 59. About 20% were hospitalized, and they think that it contributed to 8 deaths in patients over 59. And the biggest thing was that they isolated Salmonella from King Nut peanut butter, and all of the versions were produced in Blakely, Georgia, and even some Austin brand toasty peanut butter crackers were linked. So the applications is that choosy moms choose Jif for a reason.
That's what I'm talking about.
Don't go King Nut, okay?
I'm telling you, you need to go to the Keeping Up and EM website. Go to keepingupandem.com. I put a blog on this. I actually went to the FDA website because there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of products that have been recalled by the FDA. And some of the names on the FDA website are hilarious. I'm just telling you. It's like Osprey Poop. That was my favorite. Osprey Poop. You know what Osprey Poop is?
No.
It's chocolate-covered peanuts. And so this company in Montana makes, they call them their novelty poop bags. And they make moose droppings, deer droppings, osprey poop. It's hilarious. Those, so go check out the blog online and read it. It's called Peanuts and Salmonella. It's on the keepingupandem.com website. And it has links to the FDA list of products that have been recalled. Oh, and you can go through the list yourself. I promise you, you will laugh.
I mean, I laughed with King Nut. We can't get King Nut in Tennessee, and it's made in Georgia, and I had no idea.
Exactly. I'm not going with no King Nut. No. Give me Jif, baby. No.
Only King Tut.
King Nut. During our break, Sheila's been singing King Nut, the tune of King Tut. Anyway. Ooh, all right.
Oh.
So on to some other articles. This is
peanut butter jelly time.
Oh my gosh. Also Google peanut butter jelly time.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Peanut butter jelly with a baseball bat. I have not watched that in so long.
I haven't either. We might have to put that on the Keeping Up website, just like under the pediatric
blog. Oh, that's awesome. I will do that. I will find a link to the peanut butter jelly time. God. It's this little animated.
Oh my gosh, I can't remember the. Oh yeah, that is, it's hilarious.
So funny. It was It was
peanut butter than baseball. That's you're right.
Yeah.
Peanut butter jelly time. Peanut butter. Oh gosh.
Andy Huss. He wasn't on the show yet. Anyway.
Back in the day.
So this is our cold remedy update here. So we want to talk a little bit about cold remedies here. The references, there are three of them. I'm going to go through all of these. One is just paracetamol plus ibuprofen for the treatment of fever in children, the PITCH, P-I-T-C-H, randomized controlled trial. Next is association between paracetamol use in infancy and the risk of asthma, rhinoconjunctivitis, and eczema in kids age 6 to 7. This was the Isaac program in Lancet. And finally, Vicks VapoRub induced mucin secretion. This was in Chest of January 09. So here's the historical backdrop. There are many cold remedies that we use frequently with very little evidence for their efficacy or their harm. Anecdotally speaking, we always thought as parents, I did at least, with my own kids, that ibuprofen seemed better than acetaminophen in making my kids feel better more quickly. Mm-hmm. But is that true? Mm-hmm. Dun, dun, dun. There's a randomized controlled trial coming up. Next question. Is there an association with colds and asthma? Or is it the fever reducer in asthma? Bum, bum, bum. Coming up. And final, lest we forget, what about Vicks VapoRub? Surely it can't do any harm, right? It's rubbed on the outside of your body. Dun, already dun, dun. So here's the board relevance. The FDA's issued a warning about the use of cough and cold medication in children less than 2 years of age. I would suggest check out last PEDS, Keeping Up, the Sharfstein article. It was a perspective article in New England Journal of Medicine. Great title. It was over the counter, but no longer under the radar.
That's right.
That was good. And Sharfstein has gotten quite a bit of publicity.
Yeah, because of that.
Yeah, he's on the FDA Zibbity Doo Dah Day
list. Yeah.
So Obama likes him. So the FDA anyway has issued a warning about cough and cold medicine in kids less than two. A lot of overdoses have inadvertently occurred. The FDA and AAP released a statement in 2008 stating that children under two are not to be given over-the-counter cough and cold medicine, as they can cause cardiac arrhythmias, hallucinations, depressed levels of consciousness. I'm just blatantly plagiarizing Sheila's stuff from last month. The results. The first article, remember the question, is Motrin or ibuprofen better than Tylenol and making your kids feel better? I've always thought so. So which is the better fever reducer? Ibuprofen, acetaminophen, or both? Well, can you believe it? The British have actually done a randomized controlled trial comparing acetaminophen and ibuprofen. Believe it. My fatherly hunch over the years has now been confirmed with a randomized controlled trial. Ibuprofen actually is better than acetaminophen in making your kids feel better and faster. So in children 6 months to 6 years, the combination of acetaminophen and ibuprofen, if they were given together, those children have 4.4 hours less fever in a 24-hour period than acetaminophen alone. If they gave ibuprofen versus acetaminophen, the kids had 2.5 hours less fever in a 24-hour period compared to acetaminophen. The time to resolution of fever was the same whether the combination of drugs was given or whether ibuprofen versus acetaminophen was given. So what it appears is that it's the ibuprofen that really rapidly drops your temperature. That is roughly 45 minutes before the child becomes afebrile versus 71 minutes if the child was only given acetaminophen. So their conclusion is start with ibuprofen and consider both together for even faster fever relief and decreased time with fever per 24-hour period. Ibuprofen and acetaminophen work in different ways. It's not harmful to give them together, and you're probably going to have decreased time of fever in 24 hours, and they're going to drop their temp quicker if you use ibuprofen over acetaminophen. I'm just telling you, I always choose ibuprofen for my own kids. It just seems to bring them back from the dead. Yeah. They're just laying on the couch, just dead as a hammer, and you give them the Motrin, and, you know, within 45 minutes, they're up and running around.
I have to say, I'm always sad when I can see that the triage nurse gave Tylenol instead of Motrin, and it's like, oh!
Dog!
I mean, sometimes they've had Motrin on board, so yeah. You can't give it. But yeah, when those kids get ibuprofen, it's a new person.
Yeah, it's really, they're up and running. Remember the next question? Now, is it colds and asthma that's the association, or maybe it's their fever reducer and their asthma? Well, this journal article from The Lancet suggests, Beasley et al., that there is a connection between acetaminophen use and asthma. Pathophysiologically, it's thought that acetaminophen may cause some oxidant-induced airway inflammation due to its effects of glutathione depletion in the lung tissue, inducing helper T cell 2 response. Wow. What do you think of that?
Yeah, huh?
It makes sense if you can remember what a helper T cell is. So this study is a random cross-sectional analysis of 6- and 7-year-olds and assessed exposure to acetaminophen and presence of wheezing, allergic rhinoconjunctivitis, and eczema. This was by family report, so there could be some recall bias here. So what they found on multivariate analysis, kids with any exposure to acetaminophen had significantly increased risk for asthma. The odds ratio was 1.43, and this was highly statistically significant. The odds ratios were lower for allergic rhinoconjunctivitis and eczema, but still significant. So this information is compelling because the study involves over 200,000 6- and 7-year-old kids. I mean, it is a cross-sectional study, so it's not that inherently strong, but it's a lot of children. So it looks like there is an association between acetaminophen and asthma, and that association is real. So even more reason to start with some ibuprofen. Finally, Vicks VapoRub. It's got to be good for you. So, is Vicks VapoRub an evil ferret poison, or is it a cure for the common cold?
Dun, dun, dun.
Don't you wish you could have pulled out this bit of evidence when your grandma came at you with this smelly stuff every time you had a sniffle? You could say, wait, grandma, the evidence suggests. Well, what does the evidence suggest? Well, Abansis et al. Had a patient that developed severe respiratory distress after mama had rubbed some Vicks VapoRub up under his nose, which made him wonder, was it the Vicks VapoRub that increased inflammation in the airways? So, instead of removing that patient's trachea and inspecting it, they decided to do a study on ferrets. This was a nifty bench research study in which ferret tracheas were exposed to Vicks VapoRub. Some had been exposed to lipopolysaccharide to induce inflammation, and some had not. What they found was that Vicks VapoRub increased mucin production, decreased ciliary beat frequency, and increased mucociliary transport velocity in the inflamed airways. That's a mouthful, but what this is saying is this is the same thing that happens with airway irritant exposure. There's a fascinating discussion of why Vicks VapoRub makes you feel like you have more airflow in this article. I highly recommend it. It is fascinating. It is free. The link is on keepingupinem.com, the written summary, so go there today. But I'll go ahead and spill the beans because this is so cool how Vicks VapoRub works. Do you know this?
No.
Oh my gosh. Take a listen. So when you put Vicks VapoRub under your nose, it stimulates the trigeminal nerve and does something with calcium and second messengers and stuff. Probably helper T cells, I don't know. But what happens is the receptors for cold sensation are heightened. And so when you breathe in, it feels cool and it feels as if there's more airflow, even though multiple studies have measured that there's actually decreased airflow.
Oh my gosh.
So, but it feels like you have more airflow. So readers are also reminded in the article that Procter & Gamble boasts that Vicks VapoRub is, quote, the only thing more powerful than a mother's touch, end quote. More powerful indeed.
Wow.
More powerful at inducing tracheal inflammation. So, the application to your practice is this. Use ibuprofen for fever and consider acetaminophen and ibuprofen together. This is randomized control trial data. Also, know the association between acetaminophen use and asthma. It appears real, and your patients may be asking you about this. Just another reason to consider using ibuprofen first, assuming no renal disease. Finally, if your grandma comes at you with Vicks VapoRub, run like the dickens and wave this article from chest in her face. Seriously, tell your families and your patients not to use it. So that's
Stay
your
away.
Cold remedy update for 09.
Awesome. Interesting. I didn't know that about the cold receptors.
It's really
fascinating.
Gosh, that article is totally worth a read, and it's free.
I need to get that.
Free from chest. It's hilarious. The only thing, whatever, more powerful than a mother's touch.
Yeah.
Mixed vapor rub up your nose. Yeah, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, that'll do it. That's of course not the power you want.
Yeah, my mom could touch pretty hard sometimes. We're misbehaving. But that's this episode of Keeping Up, Pete's Part 2. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope it's been informative. Hope it's helped you with your practice and taking care of your patients on your next shift. That's our goal. Definitely go to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and you'll find all these podcasts, all the written summaries. You can get CME, so go there today. And Sheila, thanks again for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. And now for a little legal and CME mumbo jumbo that we have to take care of. Keeping Up is copyright Vanderbilt University, 2008-2009, all rights reserved. Please don't make copies or change the content in any way, but please do tell your friends about this because that's the way we're going to spread the word. Don't forget to get your CME credit. You can get that by going to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and follow the links. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for CME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 1.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Thanks so much for listening to Keeping Up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll listen again and tell your friends. Thanks. Bye.